Mr. Gormley, Reel 21. You wanted to correct an error that you'd made on at the end of the last tape, Mr. Gormley.
Well, it was just in retrospect of looking back, I thought, oh, I've made a false assumption. I'd have said to the lieutenant partner, the defending officer, it should have been the second lieutenant constable, going to be maybe the three of us. Make it correct because the Harkness actually was the more or less prosecution witness. Now, what happened to James after that? It's unbelievable, but it's true. I mean, they've really got to laugh about it, right? Because he was sent down to Minora Island. Compensate him for his 3 weeks spent in the prison where he shouldn't have been, in the cell where he shouldn't have been. And he was sent down to Minora Island for 3 weeks leave. So he got down to Minora Island, and unfortunately for him, he decided to go onto the mainland, and he proceeded to get himself very drunk. And of course, the MPs were always watching for things like that. And I'd have been shy in no time at all, whether they were waiting for him or not, of course, because I think he had a bit of a reputation. And they put him inside, and they escorted him back to the barracks from which he'd just come the morning before. And he was back in the cell that he came from. And he was waiting, punishment there, so they made up for him. They got him one way, or they knew they would get him.
What other memories of the Hyderabad Sindh area have you got?
Oh, there's lots of memories. I mean, we had a boxing tournament over there, and fortunately I won. And
which tournament was this? It was regimental or?
Regimental tournament. In the battery first, and then we had the regimental tournament.
And yours was the 4th Regiment, wasn't it?
Fourth regiment, yes. And we had lots of support. Now, the fields there, there was no such thing as fields. Everything was just raked and rolled, flat, it was sand. It was sand that it was raked and rolled. And that was more or less a punishment. This is what they used to use it for pulling, because I had this massive roller. And if you had two horses, you would take them all the time to pull it. And that's what they used to put the lads on janitors, used to get that. Pulling them down, he said he was a boy with his own. And it was very hard, but it really made you fast. It made you fast, you know, even playing football, hockey, which we loved hockey, everybody played hockey out there. And it made it very fast, the speed was immense. And, but you always did. Now, I went on, I got a job as a sports owner for a spell. And my job was, every time there was a sports event taking place, I had to patrol the line. And I had a book of ID.
I think we've got this on the other table about the ID, yes. For the screen, yes.
It's trying to remember. But anyway, forgetting that now, then, one of the things, I mentioned where I went as a groom for the left-handed officer. Ah, well, as an ex-driver, and each officer all had their own horses out there, and they kept it up because the law was getting poorly on that. So he asked me whether I'd like to look after his horse for me, and oh, yeah, I said, anything for a scalp. Yeah, I said, yeah, I'll take it on. And so I took it on, but I didn't see eye to eye with Simon. You know, he's one of those, like him. I thought, well, I said, yeah. I stuck him about 6 weeks. I still with him. I said, that's not good, really. And I went back to Paris, right? It was a kind of sky wide that lasted, but it wasn't what I could have seen. We've got some other things going on. It's always we went out on, I remember being out on, we went on a, you know, for about 7 days. We traveled around. we got caught in one of these fast foods. And I can absolutely remember sitting up in the middle of the night, and we were all, like, we just had a tent, and a small tent, and I was sitting up with a ground sheet wrapped around me like that, and the water flooding through the tent and past me. I wouldn't get out. I just grabbed it and put it up around me like that, and I was sitting there in this pretty flat foot, racing down the mile down the road, and pretty amazingly.
Was there many manoeuvres? Was there on an annual basis a big training period or manoeuvre?
I think the more or less they must have had an inkling that the war was coming, you know, about this time, because as I say, the training was very intense, and we're doing all this work, going out, traveling by night on comfort bed and things like that.
Were you firing a lot of live ammunition when you were training?
Oh, no. We didn't use any live ammunition.
And what were you doing at this time? Were you driving the wagon, the vehicles?
Well, that same book you done, I'll tell you about. I had a little one in with him. There was a little fellow there called Tish Foster, who was a First World War veteran, and he'd been on the wheel the night before. So I'm driving up, and this bogey down had just been with not too long, you know. And he gives this signal, which was left hand signal. So Albert moves to the left. And as I said, Tim must have been on the veer the night before, like, he swung the way around. But everybody used to follow Tim, you know. And everybody had just followed on behind him. So I've got a right bollock enough for this fella. I just stood and looked at him and I said, right, give me the signal that you gave them. And he did exactly what he said. I said, hey, yeah, you just give me the left hand signal. And I went back. I said, they went right because I'm following him. I said, right, he said, you caught me. Excuse guys for 3 weeks. Fair as money, you know, you had to be fair, like.
You were telling me that 1938-39, that the older members of the battery and the regiment were being sent off.
Yes, well, there's a few photographs on there, which I could show you. Some of those went to Danny Moore. I thought it was a great little bit old fellow, you know.
But these were old First World War men?
They were old First World War veterans, and old Danny Moore, he was well past retirement age, you know. Dougie Barker, who was my sergeant at the time, he was past retirement age, or First World War veterans. And there was other World War veterans that didn't want to go. Some of them just said, oh no, they were quite happy to stop in the regiment. And they left India because they were all married, lived in married quarters, you see. But the legs of Jack were on them, they were married, so they were involved. So, more or less, most of those that were left behind, and we brought an inland function. And then we really started preparing for war then, because the world had come down like that, we were going to be mobilised, and we all would be mobilised. So we set off, and as I said, it was very intense, well, nearly every night, doing that. And even then, we were still at the same time doing we were still getting on with everything that we would normally do. Yeah? I mean, think the story about that Bunsy Davis, and this is true, I mean, senior size was not there, heavyweight champion, about 15 stone. I was only 8 and a half. They come and all these fellas used to brood. You might have said something done 3 weeks before. Maybe it's called a silly or something like that. When you've been playing cards or something, they come to me this year. Right, he says, I'll run the back. Run the back. Run the back. He says, I've just come to my mind, 3 weeks ago, I think they caught me. called me a great name man. She said, I said, hey, you can't know about me, you. She said, so I walk out the back and make it up. I said, get on. I said, take your pick. You want to hit that side or you want to hit that side? I said, the last thing you do, straight up and do it. I said, the last thing you do, Johnson, you'll never hit anybody again. The first time you do, I said, I'll take your belly band out with a pick out and you'll not know it. And I'll not know it. Nobody will know what I'm going to do here. And he backed off because he knew what we'd do. And I put it.
But by and all, you got on very well within the unit.
He was just a warm-up. Most of the everybody was like that. It was just his way he went on. And his run races and such occurred, and even in the end, major later on, and they were coming this story. But he was one of these fellas, he couldn't get through to him. I don't know whether he was punched up or what, like, you know, suddenly coming to his mind. 3 weeks ago, you know, I mean, he'd forgotten what it was all about. It's crazy.
You said that, you know, war was obviously coming close and you started intensive training. Were you training with other units, the infantry and so forth?
Oh, yes. Mainly we were training, doing our own training. We were doing our own training, like, but there, again, there were other regiments in the vicinity. Roundabout in the whole area.
But you didn't do any one large manoeuvre with infantry and tanks and whatever?
No.
You didn't do that?
And eventually the day came, like, naturally, which is when we were taking the... Could you just stop it? Well, there was a little thing happened there. We were coming off these maneuvers and that, and we had to go and get them out and the gentleman manager was in the old regiment, in the engine old battery, actually, in the rubbish there. And he was really nice, pushing that, you know, but very nice lad. And he could read, write, and 12 different languages, all kinds, Russian and everything. Marvellous. He comes on parade on the guard mountain. I've got a laughing shout, he was thinking about, you know, because we stand on the guard mountain and he started stoking. He comes up like, we're all standing on the guard mountain, all this stood together. Like, Chris, where's your humour? How did you handle it? Lost it, Sergeant. You've lost it? Where? Lost it? Better to come on parade with no human limb at all. It's coming a chuckle, we just stood there. Ah, but Sergeant, he said, the leg of a goat is better than no goat at all. Goat, said Darby. Goat, bloody goat. He said, I'll give you a bloody goat for it, children. It'll wear the mask up the three guard away. Put him inside. Oh, it's all right, you know.
So a lot of your men must have come from a very wide background of education and everything else.
I'm surprised how many gentlemen managers there were, actually. Yeah. I would think probably be about 4 or 5, and they all used to click together, you could always see them in the canteen.
With war coming along, you say that obviously there were rumours of it and things were happening in Europe, and you were aware of this, you were actually getting this information.
Yes, it became very obvious, like that, you know, something was going to, was going to occur, like a minute it was, about May time.
This was 1939?
1939, the May time, the order came to mobilise. And we were leaving India as part of the 4th Indian Division, or as we were known as, the Indian Expeditionary Force. That's what it was, IEF. The Indian Expeditionary Force, which would... So we got it all our gear together, and we travelled down to where Karachi, and we bought in this vessel. When you look at it, I thought, oh, God, how are we going to get us on there? Like, you know. So, anyway, the guns and the women and everything were all loaded aboard, and then we set off. And it was in the monsoons was on at the time. There. I hadn't actually appeared, but there was a big swell on the course. And I'd gone in this course there, and there was a ship called the Varela. Ship called the Varela. And there were only about 4,000 tons, I think, something like that. So, I don't think it had been out of sight of land, and there'd been one of them who just tripped around the coast all the way, you know. I don't think it had been out of sight of land for years. We set off from Karachi after getting everything loaded on. And two days out, one of the boilers broke down. So we were left with one boiler. And the rest of the convoy just steamed away ahead until the water flashed away, carry on at your own speed, and just get there. So they just steamed the way ahead. And the day after that, as I say, there's a bit of seas. The wind, roof, there was just a big swell on all the time that was just up and down and up and down. And all the stokers and that, the native stokers that I had, they were all sick and ill, nobody could do it. And we called for volunteers to stoke the boiler. So, anything for it. So we volunteered to stoke the boiler. Plus a lot of wood on that side, you know. We all volunteered, you know. We went down and did about 4 hours at the time. Which was enough in that thing, right, you know. So we went down and we did this tour stint. And what we got for that recompense, we got a 1 pint of ice cold milk out the fridge. Why did we get any pay? Nothing else. All you got was a pint of ice cold milk out of the fridge. And believe me, that was nectar to the gods in that heat, you know. And the lads used to stand there and hadn't volunteered, they used to stand under there and die and ask you for a drink, mate. They wouldn't dare ask you for one because you wouldn't get anywhere near it. And that's what we used to do.
What were conditions like on the ship, for sleeping and eating conditions?
They were very rough, actually. The only ventilation that we had on the ship, actually, was they had these, like a funnel sheet, and they came down from down into the lower decks. Mine was very close in there, because it had just been rapidly converted into a filter, if you understand what I mean, and there was very little headroom at all. And they had these little sheets. But we thought it was to step on the deck. If you found a space, if you're sharp enough to get up and claim a space, we slept on the deck all the way. We never even went below, you know. We just slept there. So there was no room, there was nothing. We couldn't even do any deal, anything like that, you know.
Oh, you're pretty packed.
Yeah, pretty packed, yeah. So we sailed on like that. And these natives never ever came back to do the stoking, you know. I don't know how they ever got back to India. Because they never ever came back to do any stoking. We carried that whole ship right across up through the Red Sea.
Did you know where you were going?
We knew we were going heading for Egypt, but we didn't know where. We just knew, said, you're definitely going to Egypt. But they didn't say where. So we pulled in, we came up like through the Red Sea, which I had to help. And we came through the Red Sea, past the end.
How long did the journey take?
It took us nearly as long to do that as it did the journey from England to India in the first place. Because we were only working on one boiler. It took us nearly 3 weeks, I don't know, somewhere about the same time.
So that you must have been getting pretty bored and. They kept you occupied one way or another.
Were
they giving you any talks or lectures about Egypt, sorry, and the area?
No, I'm being very sure. Well, from what they've read, I suppose, like anybody else, you know. I mean, you've got plenty talking about BD and whatnot. You know, that was the main thing. They just keep pumping it in here, not pumping it in here. And as I say, we got through a couple of past even. It's a hell of a place. I'm in Lake Reef Station there. And because it was a coaling station, you know, because we found that out when we were going out. We stopped there to call you because everybody was calling the call. And
you didn't get ashore, did you? At
no,
Aden,
no. We never came ashore from there until we reached Port Tewfik. We got to Port Tewfik.
Yeah, do you recall what date this was when you got to Tewfik?
About middle of June. Middle of June.
And was the whole division in the rest of the convoy?
They'd
gone ahead of you.
But
it was the whole division moving.
We were just the latter part of the division, you know. We were the last end of the
And they put the 4th Indian Division into Egypt as early as early June of 1939.
Early June. We were there. The whole division was there. I mean, we should have been there with them. You know, we should have been all landing more or less together. But it was just interesting. And but as I say, we got the Port Tewfik, and then we were allowed to disembark at Tewfik. And we thought we were going on from there because they sent us there, and we went out to this transit camp. And fortunately, we had a bit of a good meal there for a change, you know, because we'd been living in. And we went there, and then when we came back, you know, everything had been unloaded, or we were in the process of being unloaded. So we just more or less hung about there and picked the wagons up as they came off and went to go.
What was your first impressions of Egypt?
Sand. Sand, no good sand. It's funny, like it is true. There is a little bit of irrigation around the shores of the canal and that, like, you know, but mainly it's sure it is, you know, that you only got to move in a couple of yards and you're into sand, you know. And we travelled from there across the sand, and there wasn't even a waterway, like, you know, and there was a track there, like, you know, there was a road there, like, it was just like a sand road, you know. And they must have known where we were going, like, because eventually, we got there, we saw these spires not rising above the mist. We had no clue where it was, you know. We had no clue where we were. We were just traveling across the planet together.
And this was convoy. You were driving your truck here, were you?
Driving convoy, yeah. We were all going to members, all behind each other, all the way. And we were up there, and of course, we got into Cairo. And we didn't come through the centre of Cairo, we went on the outskirts. We didn't know much about a circle of the route. So they took us on the outskirts, and all we could say to ourselves was, God, we had no clue how large it was, or even what there was in there, you know. We heard everybody talking about Cairo, and that was it. We never even seen it, or, you know, we knew nothing at all about it. So we went through past the tunnel, we went through the outskirts, and then we come onto a lovely, like, it was a metal road, like, when we actually got near the tunnel, it was a metal road, we went running out, like, out to the little outside area and that. But the main bit of the road, like, was just a sand, you know, it was a mark or anything. And we got out of there, because we were there and there was a beautiful tarmac road and carried us right up to the pyramids. We turned up as we got right up and we didn't know the pyramids were there. You know, I mean, we heard of the pyramids of Egypt, but we never actually seen them. And of course, when we got up, we could see these pretty pyramids appearing before us. You know, that's the pyramids, you know. This was the site where we were staying. And then we pulled in past the Mina House Hotel, turned down to the right, down this road, and about 3 minutes, 4 minutes walk from there, that's where we had our camp. Our camp was all right on the verge of completing the beach. We only had a 3 minute walk to walk the main road to get the tram into town.
And that was into Cairo, into the city.
The main stop was at the main house of town. And then you had this lovely town, and all women perfectly, you know, because it's three months, you see. And young ladies and everybody all on there, all on sitting on the town, with the lovely, lovely hats on the back, you know. And then my one lad, he took the tavern out the wheel, and the wind caught it and it blew it back in. And the duck on his ass has happened, he ended up in the defense, he shouted, tell her the hat was on fire.
Was this a permanent camp that you were...
This was a camp that had been specially built for the Indian Expedition Force. And it was just outside...
Was it tents or huts or what?
Tents. All tents. And all the things were tents. They were all tents. Even the toilet was a bloody tent. I couldn't do it eventually. It was all tented camp. It was the whole division there. So you can imagine the extent. And we were fortunate because we were right on the end of the bridge, and we just come off the metal road and we were in our camp. Because the metal road there come down and past our camp, and that was the road that went straight through to Alexander. Okay, so we were right on the edge of the road, right, and we couldn't have been better if we wanted.
What amenities had you in the camp?
In the camp itself, in the camping, nothing else. Sand and more sand. I've got photographs up there. We've shown the pyramids as well. It was very deep sand. Sand was very deep. Everything was stuck well down there to keep it down. And then we had them down there.
And the tents.
So they had a tent. They were mainly the majority of their what? An EPIP tent.
What's an EPIP tent?
I'm trying to think of the size of it. It'll be about twice the size of this one.
A bell tent or a rectangular?
A straight rectangular tent.
Quite a large one.
Quite a large one. It would hold, even kitten as we were. 1 by 30 men.
And what were you sleeping on?
The deck.
You didn't have metal beds, or? And of course, you mentioned the toilet being a tent, or toilets being a tent.
All the toilet was a big, about 4 or 5, depending on the size. Each battery had its own toilet area. And you had about 6 big buckets, and I mean large buckets, about that big.
About three foot wide, kind of.
About 2 feet, 3 foot wide. And it could be good big buckets. And that's what we used. And then they would come up and empty them, they would be empty the end of the day. still got the aluminium that was still there, and all of the sweet and everything that they had in India. Well, I they came with them. They did all that. Nobody else took them any muck or anything like that. They were, that was all done by the Indians, since that we had with us. We had all our main communities here, we took all the Indians, drivers, and everything.